I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate. Vulnerability, shame, and fear. These are words, emotions, and sensations that we usually try to avoid in our daily lives. But Brené Brown has been bravely bringing them up in conversation for years. Through her research, the professor of social work has found that developing our capacity to deal with these emotions can help us connect with each other and lead fuller lives. Her latest book is called Daring Greatly, How the Courage to be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. It's published by Gotham Books, and I'm pleased that it brings Dr. Brené Brown to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
I also want to let our listeners know that we'll be taking phone calls later this hour. You can call us at 212-433-9692. Brené, I had the great pleasure of seeing your talk at TED this year, and you talked a lot about shame and vulnerability. And I'd love for you, for our listeners, to define what you mean by those two different terms.
Well, I started off, 12 years ago, really studying very specifically connection, shame, and empathy. And so when I talk about shame, I'm talking about that really painful and powerful emotion that washes over us, that makes us feel not enough, that kind of fills us with the fear that we are not blank enough, and we can all fill in the gaps, not good enough, rich enough, thin enough, pretty enough, perfect enough, promoted enough, loved enough. Shame is kind of the never enough issue. And, in the course of doing the research on shame and learning kind of what is this thing that keeps us feeling small and kind of not worthy of love and belonging, I kept running into vulnerability. I kept running into, I guess the one thing I learned that was probably the real foundational learning for me in the research was that that love and belonging are very irreducible needs for men, women, and children. And if, we're just hardwired, I believe neurobiologically hardwired for love and belonging. I think it's in our DNA.
So that it's like food. We need food, shelter, and love and belonging.
Right. Absolutely. And in the absence of love and belonging, I think it's very safe to say that there is always suffering in the absence of love and belonging. And so if you take the folks that I've interviewed over the last 12 years and kind of crudely divided them into two groups, folks who really struggle for a sense of love and belonging, and people who feel that love and belonging, there was only one variable that separated those groups, and that was that the folks who had that strong sense of love and belonging simply believed that they are worthy of love and belonging. And when that emerged, my first thought was, well, maybe their lives panned out just beautifully. Maybe this is the group of people that, everything went really well. They don't get stretch marks. They don't get fired. They don't have,
There isn't any struggle in those lives.
No, there's no family interventions. There's, just things work out differently. And so we went back in to the data and looked, and there weren't fewer divorces or bankruptcies or histories of trauma or addiction. There was simply a sense of worthiness that was really, when I tried to operationalize what does that mean, what kept coming up were daily choices that were very much grounded in vulnerability. These were men and women who were not afraid to show up and be seen. They were not, and maybe they were afraid. Maybe that's not fair. They were willing to show up and be seen.
They did it anyway,
even if
they were afraid.
And they were also men and women who made qualitatively different choices than I think certainly I made at the time and most of the people I knew made. In terms of, I'll give you an example. These were folks who really cultivated time for rest and play in their lives. And in order to do that, they kind of had to stare down the shame of the cultural messages that we're all up against, which is exhaustion is a status symbol and productivity is self-worth. And so they were really made what I would consider to be very vulnerable, almost counterculture choices about their lives.
And you write also about resilience. And it sounds like that's a piece of this, the resilience to be able to say, I know this is what everybody else is saying that we should do, but I need to do it differently.
Absolutely. And I think resilience, you know, for me, the best definition of resilience is the most simple. It's, you know, some bounce back. And the one thing about shame that we know is it's the most human, primitive affect that we experience. You know, shame is a human experience, and we all have it. I mean, going on 40 years of data that really point to the fact that everyone experiences shame. And, you know, the very, very few people who don't really experience shame are people who have no capacity for empathy or connection. So by and large, we all experience shame.
And you kind of want to be able to experience shame. It sounds like
Right.
You don't want to get rid of it entirely.
Right. And I mean, I think, you know, yeah, I think the other options, like sociopathology, I think shame is the only time shame's a good option, maybe. But I think we all have it. We all know that warm wash of inadequacy that can, you know, just wash over us and send us reeling. I mean, we all know it. And so the question becomes, you know, if we're hardwired for connection, and shame is basically the fear of disconnection, that there's something about us, something we've done or failed to do, that makes us unworthy of connection, of love, of belonging. The question becomes then, how can we become more resilient so that when it does happen, we can move through it constructively and possibly even cultivate more courage and compassion as a result of the experience, as opposed to what most of us do by default, which when we're in shame is engage in behaviors that further drive shame.
So as you looked at this data and the people whom you had interviewed, what stood out for those who were resilient, who were able to experience that shame and still, as you say, show up and be seen the next time and possibly make mistakes and do things wrong the next time too?
You know, there were a lot of things. I think first and foremost, I think some understanding, you know, first I think you have there were four elements that men and women who had high levels of shame resilience, specifically talking about shame, there were four really, I think, cognitive, behavioral, and effective skill sets that these folks had in common, four things that helped them move through shame. And the first is they knew what shame was. They knew that they knew what it was, and they knew when they were in it. You know, and so they knew what triggered it.
And so you have to be able to identify it and really say, oh, that's what this is.
Right. And I think one of the things that gets very confusing for people, for all of us, is that we often confuse shame with guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that guilt's a very healthy, adaptive emotion. Shame, on the other hand, is, I think, debilitating and very likely to be the source of destructive behaviors, not the cure to it. So
tell me how you define those two things differently, because I think you're right. I think a lot of people do confuse the two.
I think the most kind of basic answer is that shame is a focus on self and guilt is a focus on behavior. So if I get into a situation where, let's say, I am supposed to, we'll use a real life situation for me.
Those are always the best.
Because I'm struggling with along with the rest of the world with reentry after the holidays. I'm supposed to meet someone for lunch. And it's 20 minutes after I'm supposed to meet him, and I get a call on my cell phone. I'm all the way across town. I completely forgot, which is a terrible feeling. Hey, I'm at the restaurant. Where are you? Shame, a focus on self. God, I'm so stupid. I'm such an idiot. I'm a horrible friend. Guilt. I can't believe I did that. That was a really careless thing to do. That's guilt. You know, the focus on self versus the focus on the behavior. Am I stupid or did I do a careless thing? And so what we see is that shame proneness means we use self-talk that really focuses on self more than behavior. You know, from a parenting perspective, it's the difference between you're a bad kid or you're a great kid who made a bad choice.
And I was thinking about parenting, which is a piece of what you talk about in the book, because it sounds like a lot of this starts very early of how we see ourselves in the world as kids.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing that's so important to understand is that shame and guilt have very, very different outcomes. Shame is highly, highly correlated with addiction, depression, violence, aggression, suicide, bullying, eating disorders. We're finding guilt seems to be inversely correlated, meaning the more you're able to gauge your self-talk on a focus on behavior rather than a focus on self, the less likely you are to end up with those outcomes. And so there is a tremendous difference. And so, you know, and I think guilt is, you know, guilt's uncomfortable. It's when we hold something we've done or failed to do up against our values, and there's, you know, the cognitive dissonance. It's there's some room, you know, we're not aligned with our values. And so I think the first thing that's important is to really understand what shame is and to understand where those messages and expectation come, where they come from. And like you said, I think a lot of them, the majority of them, in fact, are probably planted in our families of origin.
And in a moment, I'm going to want you to elaborate on the four different aspects, because I know I cut you off before you got to them. But we have to take a break. I'm speaking with social researcher Dr. Brené Brown about her latest book, Daring Greatly, How the Courage to be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. It's published by Gotham Books, and we'll have more after a break. The new season of Downton Abbey is here, with the mother-in-law from America coming to stay. On the next Fresh Air, Terry Gross talks with the show's creator, writer and producer Julian Fellows. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 FM, WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by Cornell University, offering two executive MBA programs for mid-career managers and professionals. Weekend classes in Metro New York. Admissions events January 16th and 17th in New York City. More at cornellemba.com. The Charles H. Revson Foundation, because a great city needs an informed and engaged public. Learn more at revsonfoundation.org. WNYC is a media partner of Global Fest 10th Anniversary Celebration, featuring international music on three stages at Webster Hall, Sunday, January 13th, beginning at 7 p.m. Details and tickets at globalfest.org.
And now, another WNYC sustaining member haiku, as read by Brooke Gladstone.
Cherished stations mine? Duh! AM 820 and 93.9. Madhuri Mukherjee, Montclair, New Jersey.
Become a sustaining member today. Go to WNYC.org and click on support, or call 1-888-376-WNYC.
Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Julie Burstein, in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Brené Brown, the author of Daring Greatly, How the Courage to be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead, and it's from Gotham Books. We can take your calls, too, 212-433-9692. Brené, before the break, you had started talking about four things that help us become shame resilient. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think the first one is understanding what shame is and kind of understanding the differences between shame and guilt, recognizing when we're in it. And then the other kind of strategies become very counterintuitive, at least they were for me. They are kind of talking to ourselves in the midst of shame the way we would talk to someone we really care about or love. You know, I mean, I can tell a very quick story that I share in Daring Greatly. It was not one of my finer moments, but nonetheless, a real moment. I had received an invitation to speak in an event, and I emailed this person back. It was a man, and I emailed him back and said, thank you so much for the invitation. I've got a family commitment. I'm sorry, I can't make it. And then seconds later, I receive another email back that said, you, and wholeheartedness is a term I use a lot in my research. And I said, he said, you are not wholehearted at all. You're selfish. I can't believe you're not going to come speak for us. I mean, it was just very inappropriate and kind of mean-spirited. Well, it immediately threw me kind of in a shame spiral, because one of my gremlins, my shame gremlins, is kind of the good girl. Make everybody happy. Don't disappoint anyone. And so it took me off guard, and I broke my golden rule of the shame experience, which is when you're in shame, don't talk, text, or type anything.
Which is very good advice, I think.
Yeah, so you get back on your emotional feet, you know, because what most of us have a tendency to do when we're in shame is engage in a behavior that exacerbates shame. So I don't listen to my own advice here. And I forward the email to my husband with about a paragraph, just a tirade, every curse word you can imagine, how mad I am at this guy. And I hit reply instead of forward. And so, you know, my computer makes that whoosh sound, you know, and I'm like, no, come back. And then I go into a real kind of shame storm. And so I tried, you know, I knew exactly what was happening, because one of the things I think is interesting is that men and women with high levels of shame resilience, physically, they know physically when they're in shame. Shame has a very strong physiology for us, you know. So for me, I know, you know, my armpits tingle, time slows down, my mouth gets dry, I get tunnel vision. And I knew that it was going to take me, you know, I closed my computer, I walked away, I kind of walked around, did some deep breathing, and then I did two very counterintuitive things. I tried to talk to myself in a kind of gentle way, like, you know what, you're human. If you're on email, you're going to do this eventually. And then the big thing that's hard is you need to reach out and tell your story, because shame cannot tolerate being spoken. You know, shame needs three things to really grow exponentially in our lives: silence, secrecy, and judgment. And it needs one thing to really dissipate, and that's empathy. And so I called my husband, and I called a very good friend, and, you know, they said, we love you, you're human, we've both done this, you're not alone, which is just the real antidote to shame, is you're not alone. And then I was able to get back on my feet, reply, apologize, set some boundaries about further communications, and move forward. And so I think the thing that's hard about shame is that shame loves and craves silence, which is why it loves perfectionism, you know, and perfectionists, because it's so easy to keep people like me quiet. But I think the real key is reaching out, sharing our story, and moving forward.
And it's interesting hearing your own story, which I think many of us can relate to. One of the things you point to also is self-reflection, whether it's right after the thing that makes you feel shameful, taking a break so that you don't, as you say, react in shame. And then even when it's worse, being kind to yourself, which I think is something very hard for many people. We can have it in us to be kind to people outside of ourselves, but how do we practice being kind to ourselves?
Now I have to totally fake it most of the time. I have no answer for you. I'm still working. You know what I do? I picture my kids. I picture either Ellen or Charlie, and I picture if Ellen was at the computer and she went, oh, my God, Mom, I just sent this email. And I would never look at her and say, oh, my God, you're so stupid. You're such an idiot. I would never, ever, ever talk to her that way. I would say, okay, just breathe. Hold on. We'll figure it out. You're human. You made a mistake. We'll fix it. Let's catch our breath first. You know, that's how I would talk to her. And I don't, you know, and if I think if we could get in the habit of talking to ourselves like we talk to people we care about, we could maybe change the world.
You know, and it's interesting you saying that. For my kids, when they make a big mistake, I often say, you know what? You can't change what happens, but you can change what you do next. Let's think about that. And I screwed up big time a few weeks ago, and I heard my 17-year-old saying, Mom, you can't change what happened, but you can change what you do next. And it was like, okay, I'm glad you're telling me that, because I wasn't going to tell myself that.
No, right. And so, and I think it's hard, and that's why I think shame thrives in silence, because I think if it can keep us quiet, you know, not reaching out, in isolation, beating ourselves up, it just thrives. But the moment we, you know, the moment we find the courage, I mean, I think that's what Daring Greatly is about. You know, one of the things that these very shame resilient, kind of, I call them the wholehearted, had in common, the biggest thing they shared in common, along with a sense of worthiness, was the willingness to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the willingness, and I think in every practice that I've seen related to wholeheartedness, these choices that folks make that really, I think, lead to worthiness, vulnerability underpinned every single one of them.
And by vulnerability, you know, the quote that you take from Theodore Roosevelt is basically about how if we don't step up and dare greatly and probably fail greatly, we'll never do anything. And we shouldn't listen to the critics, because we are at least attempting something. And is that when you talk about vulnerability, is that what you mean, is this sort of willingness to get up and try something and have ourselves out there, even though we may screw up and that will leave us vulnerable?
Yeah, I mean, when we asked people, you know, I think the mythology is that vulnerability is weakness. I think there are some major big myths about vulnerability, the biggest being that vulnerability is weakness. But when we asked people, what is vulnerability to you? We heard things like, vulnerability is the first date after my divorce. Vulnerability is trying to get pregnant after my second miscarriage. Vulnerability is starting my own business, negotiating a raise, sitting with my wife who has stage 4 breast cancer and talking about the future for our young kids, picking up the phone and calling a friend whose child was just killed. Vulnerability is, you know, it's saying I love you first.
So it's about connection, that's...
Absolutely. And it is about, you know, there's just no equation in those examples where I can get to weakness. It is, in my opinion, vulnerability is our greatest measure of courage. It is, are we willing, you know, I define vulnerability as simply uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. Are we willing to show up?
Why is it then, if it's so crucial to the connection that we most of us yearn for with other people, why do we try to avoid it as much as possible?
You know, very coincidentally, started my research 6 months before 9/11. And in the last, you know, decade plus, what I have seen is we are a culture of people in deep fear, in deep uncertainty. You know, I write about, I mean, even before the tragedy in Newton and Aurora, I write about school shootings. I write about 9/11. I write about all of these things happening, recession and, you know, people losing homes. And I think the more uncertain we feel and the more political, social, economic uncertainty there is, we start to lose our tolerance for vulnerability. We literally, physically feel like, I can't do it. Everything is uncertain enough, and I just want to, you know, that's my personality type. I want to lock down everything I can because there's too much I can't lock down. And the hard part is that vulnerability is the birthplace of every meaningful experience in our lives. Empathy, love, trust, joy. I mean, I would say, you know, and this is coming from me as a shame researcher, I think the most difficult emotion or affect to experience in our lives is joy. I mean, joy can feel terrorizing because what we're all afraid of is the other shoe to drop.
Is what happens next, exactly.
Right. We don't want to lean into it. And so without some capacity for vulnerability, it's really hard to soften into joy and let it wash over us and hold it and be joyful.
And I think it's hard, too, the way you're describing it. You know, we do live in a time where there is a lot of uncertainty and fear, and that makes us feel like we need to control things. But even that is kind of an illusion, because the more we lock down, the less we're able to actually be in the world.
That's beautifully said. It's exactly right. And I think when I ask people, I mean, I've just seen fear run roughshod over our families and our communities and our organizations the last decade. And I would say that we're at a very important tipping point culturally. And I think, to be honest with you, I think we're tired of being afraid. Mm-hmm. I think people are tired of the conversation focusing on what should I be afraid of and who's to blame for that. I think we want to dare greatly as individuals, as families, as a culture. And I think that that's going to require the willingness to own a lot of uncertainty. And, you know, and the reason why, you know, when I read that Roosevelt quote, it just took my breath away. And I thought, you know, he said, it's not the critic who counts. It's not the man who points at the strong man who stumbles. The credit goes to the person who's in the arena. And the part I loved was, it doesn't matter whether you're victorious or you're losing. You're daring greatly because you're in there. And I think if you're going to show up and be seen, I think if you're going to try new things and talk about how you really feel, I think you're going to get your butt kicked. I think it's a given. But I just think it's worth it, because as terrifying and dangerous as uncertainty and vulnerability sound to us, myself included, I don't think it's as dangerous as getting to the end of our lives and looking back and wondering, what if I had been all in?
You know, I'm looking at the time. We only have a few minutes left, and I did say that we could take calls, so let's go to one of our listeners. This is Liz from Allendale, New Jersey. Liz, do you have a question for Brené Brown?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Brown. I just I wanted to say that I really appreciate your work, and I'm just so grateful, in addition to the fact that it was the Christmas present I gave out this year, so thank you. My question relates to I have a daughter who sounds like she's about Ellen's age. She's 12 and a half. She's in seventh grade. I'm trying very hard to be the kind of woman that I hope she grows up to be, but I'm in that gap period that you describe, so I'm trying to mind the gap, and in the meantime, wondering if you had any kinds of tips or things to say to girls at that tender age where they're mostly concerned about what their friends think. She's in a period of, like, you know, not really being exactly where she wants to be. She doesn't look the way she wants to look. If somebody doesn't sit with her at the lunchroom, it's all hell's broken loose.
And I hate to cut this off, but we only have a minute left.
Any tips for teenagers?
You know, first I say I so appreciate, and I'm in that trench with you, and she is my daughter's age, and I think what I have found to be really powerful, almost profoundly transformative with our kids, is when I sit down and when Ellen comes home and she has that lunchroom issue, or Charlie has some issue, when Steve and I tell stories around when we were that same age, when we were in those struggles, and I think our kids forget that we were there too at one time. And I think Ellen just told me 2 days ago during break, she said, I really appreciate when you tell me you're struggling, because I forget that I'm not the only one, and I forget that that I'm not alone in this. And so I think sometimes, you know, when she comes home and tells that story, I'll say, I want to hear more about it, because I can remember when I was when I was a freshman and this happened, and I never thought those stories would be handy, but now I've got a whole library of horrific stories from high school that I can lean on. And I think that really helps to know, you know, because when you say, hey, you'll get through this, you know, it's a blip in time.
But if you say, I've gotten through it, it's a whole different thing.
Right.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Dr. Brené Brown about her latest book called Daring Greatly, How the Courage to Be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. It's published by Gotham Books. Brené, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, and I loved your talk.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.